From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is a special report on coronavirus. I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro. This hour will give you the best information that we have right now on the COVID-19 pandemic. That's the illness caused by the new coronavirus. The virus has already killed over 5,000 people and has made many more sick in at least 120 countries. We'll tell you how this new strain of the virus can turn deadly and how, in just a few months, it's had a seismic impact on how we live our lives. President Trump has now declared the coronavirus crisis a national emergency. But we'll look at how American efforts to stop the virus compare to other countries. Stay with us for our NPR special report, COVID-19, What You Need to Know About Coronavirus. Late last year, a new strain of coronavirus was identified in Wuhan, China. Over the past few months, the virus has raced around the globe, paralyzing economies, forcing people to stay at home, challenging governments and healthcare networks. The virus has hit China along with South Korea, Italy, and Iran the hardest so far. But there have also been deaths here in the United States, and epidemiologists warn there will be more. The illness the virus causes, called COVID-19, has also made over 130,000 people sick worldwide and counting. Over the next hour, we'll hear about what the virus is, the impact it's having, and how to stay healthy. First, a look at the disease itself. While more than 5,000 people have died after getting coronavirus, around 70,000 people have recovered, and most coronavirus cases have been mild. What does it mean to have mild COVID-19, and how does it turn fatal? NPR's Maria Godoy tells us.
The first symptoms of COVID-19 are pretty common.
Fever and their dry cough.
Dr. Carlos Del Rio is a professor of medicine and global health at Emory University.
Then you go on to develop shortness of breath. Some people also can get a headache, sore throat.
Fatigue has also been reported, and less commonly, diarrhea. But global health officials say about 80% of cases turn out to be mild, anything from cold-like symptoms to that flu-like feeling of being hit by a train. Doctors say these patients should be monitored, but they don't require serious medical intervention. So how does it turn deadly? Well, the virus attacks the lungs, and in about 20% of patients, infections can get more severe. Dr. Yoko Furuya is an infectious disease specialist at Columbia University Irving Medical Center.
Because our body senses all of those viruses as basically foreign invaders, that triggers our immune system to sweep in and try to contain and control the virus and stop it from making more and more copies of itself.
She says the virus can kill lung cells as it replicates inside them. But the immune system response can also destroy lung tissue and cause inflammation.
That's what can lead to an actual pneumonia.
With pneumonia, the air sacs in your lungs become inflamed and may be filled with fluid, making it harder to breathe. Del Rio says it can also make it harder for the lungs to get oxygen to your blood. That triggers a cascade of problems.
The lack of oxygen leads to more inflammation, more problems in the body that eventually lead. Organs need oxygen to function, right? So when you don't have oxygen there, then your liver dies and your kidney dies.
That's what seems to be happening in the most critical cases. According to the World Health Organization, about 3-5% of people end up in intensive care. Many of these patients have trouble breathing on their own. In extreme cases, they need a machine to breathe for them.
From what we know right now, many of the more serious infections have been in people older than 60.
Furuya says as we get older, our immune systems get weaker. And for long-term smokers, it could be even worse because their airways and lungs are more vulnerable.
And then there are people with more serious illness from this coronavirus that have had other chronic illnesses like heart disease or diabetes.
Furuya says those kinds of underlying medical conditions can make it harder for the body to recover from infections. Preliminary estimates suggest about 2% of COVID-19 cases are fatal. Most deaths appear to be the result of multi-organ failure. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
There's a lot we still don't know about the transmission of coronavirus. How long does it live outside the body? Is it airborne? There's new evidence that it can live on some surfaces for up to 3 days. But which surfaces? Here's NPR's Allison Aubrey.
The new study looked at the novel coronavirus in a laboratory setting and found the virus can survive up to 72 hours on stainless steel and plastic surfaces, and on cardboard, up to 24 hours. Jamie Lloyd-Smith of UCLA is one of the authors.
We're talking about potentially days of infectivity on some of these surfaces.
The study gives a range of possible survival times. But keep in mind, in a lab, all the conditions are stable. In the real world, factors such as sunlight can kill off viruses faster. Lloyd-Smith collaborated with scientists at the Rocky Mountain Laboratories, a federal lab, to do a series of experiments. They picked up bits of virus from surfaces that had been contaminated. They then put the virus in cell cultures to test whether it was still infectious. They also tested how long the virus remained viable in the air.
What these experiments show is that the virus can remain viable floating in the air for some number of hours. The experiments went out to 3 hours and there were still viable viruses present.
Lloyd-Smith says this experiment definitely does not prove that people have been infected this way by particles of virus that float in the air, what scientists call aerosolized transmission. He says what remains unknown is what dose is needed to infect someone.
There are a lot of things we don't know, so we do not yet know how many viral particles need to get into somebody's airway to initiate an infection.
In all these tests, the new coronavirus tends to behave a lot like an older one, SARS, that led to an outbreak in 2003. In fact, the new study shows both viruses remain viable about the same amount of time. But that leads to an important question. Why has this virus spread much more widely? Lloyd-Smith says there could be multiple reasons.
Things like the apparent ability of this novel virus to be transmitted and shed by people who aren't showing severe symptoms or may not be showing symptoms at all, which makes this virus much harder to contain.
And given all this, the advice that we've been hearing for weeks now remains the same. Wash your hands. That's still the best way to protect yourself. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
One of the biggest problems plaguing the U.S. response to the new coronavirus has been a lack of testing. New cases continue to pop up in state after state, and people have grown increasingly frustrated with the inability to be tested for COVID-19, which has already killed dozens of people here in the United States. NPR health correspondent Rob Stein joins us now. Hi, Rob.
Hey, Lulu.
So first of all, explain why testing is so important.
Well, you know, when you're fighting a new virus like this, being able to test people for the infection is really crucial. It provides the lifeblood of any effective response. Because if you don't know who's infected, you're basically flying blind. And it's especially problematic in a situation like this, when it's a respiratory infection that has a lot of the same symptoms as other common health problems like the flu. If you don't know who has the coronavirus, you don't know who to isolate to prevent them from spreading it. You don't know who to quarantine because they may have been exposed. You can't spot new outbreaks early to try to stamp them out. You don't know which cities or towns are the hotspots, which hospitals are about to get overwhelmed. It really hamstrings the campaign to fight back.
So what has been the very real and very widespread problem with testing here in the United States? Why are we so far behind?
Yeah, so for weeks and weeks, the only testing that was available in the United States was at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, in Atlanta, which at least initially had very strict criteria for who could be tested. That really created a bottleneck in the testing. The CDC finally started sending out tests to state and local labs, but those first test kits turned out to be flawed. Most labs couldn't get it to work. The CDC finally resolved that problem, but those initial missteps may have squandered a window of opportunity to get ahead of the virus and limit the spread in the United States.
I mean, that seems like a really catastrophic series of mistakes.
Yeah.
Where are we now?
So a lot more testing is finally happening now. All those public health labs around the country are finally testing. Big private commercial testing companies have come online. Some individual hospitals are doing their own testing. And the Trump administration is finally rushing to get even more testing available, doing things like enlisting more private companies, improving new tests, allowing more labs to test, and funding the development of faster tests. But there's still not nearly enough testing available today.
And meanwhile, of course, we know that the disease is spreading. So what's being done in the meantime?
Yeah, so in the absence of wide-scale testing, public health officials are stressing that the main thing people can do to help fight the virus is basically stay away from each other. Mm. You know, so-called social distancing. That's why we're seeing so many things shutting down. You know, schools closing, big events like South by Southwest and St. Patrick's Day parades and the Boston Marathon getting canceled or postponed. People being told to work from home. That's all aimed at preventing people who may have been infected from spreading it to other people, especially people who may be most vulnerable to getting sick, like the elderly.
That's NPR health correspondent Rob Stein. Thank you so much.
No problem. You bet.
And as the world struggles to try to contain the coronavirus, scientists are racing to develop one of medicine's most powerful weapons, a vaccine. Earlier, Rob talked with my colleague Scott Simon about how that vaccine is still a long ways away.
President Trump said, wrongly, that a vaccine is closer than it really is. Where are we really?
Yeah, so there are a bunch of vaccines in the pipeline already. In fact, doctors are about to start injecting at least one of them into people very soon, within the next few weeks, to see, first of all, if it's safe. That's a vaccine that was developed by the National Institutes of Health in record time, actually. I just talked with Lisa Jackson about this. She's at the Kaiser Permanente Washington Health Research Institute, and she's in charge of testing this vaccine in people for the first time.
You know, we found out about this new virus in January, and now, you know, we have vaccine supply to conduct a trial in March, and that's unprecedented. That is so rapid.
So, Rob, do we know how this vaccine works?
Yeah. So, you know, we're used to thinking about vaccines being made out of the actual virus that we're fighting, you know, from weakened or dead versions of the virus. But this vaccine is nothing like that. It's made out of genetic code. And that code tells cells in the body to make a protein. It's called a spike protein that this coronavirus uses to infect our bodies. The idea is that this will set off kind of an alarm in our immune systems to crank out antibodies so we're ready to fight off this virus if we're ever exposed to it. And so far, it looks like it's working, at least in experiments where they injected it into mice. So Jackson has already started recruiting dozens of volunteers in Seattle to be the first people to get it, to first start to see if it's safe.
Now that sounds promising, but there's a distance to go, isn't there?
Yes, yes. I'm sorry to say that it's not going to be ready anytime soon. Here's Lisa Jackson again talking about this.
We're working as fast as possible because we're faced with this crisis. But, you know, we're not going to have a vaccine for a year and a half.
Why does it take a year and a half?
So it just takes time to make a totally new vaccine like this. Even if it looks like it's safe, doctors have to then test it in a lot more people to make sure that's the case. You know, remember, this is something you're going to be giving to healthy people, potentially millions of healthy people. So even a small risk could end up doing a lot of harm.
And is it likely, Rob, that they could develop a vaccine that could avoid this virus recurring yearly?
You know, so a vaccine, it certainly would be a powerful tool to try to get this outbreak under control. Unfortunately, a vaccine won't come in time to prevent this from coming back next winter if it turns out to have a seasonal pattern, you know, like the flu. But if it does come roaring back or is just still around, a vaccine may at least be far enough along to try to push forward with the testing.
NPR's health correspondent, Rob Stein, thanks so much.
You bet, Scott.
Now we're going to look at the ways authorities around the world are responding to this pandemic. The Trump administration's handling of the crisis has been heavily criticized. The president has given confusing advice, contradicting his own experts and misleading the public about timelines for testing and vaccinations. Morning Edition's Rachel Martin spoke to three of NPR's international correspondents about how other countries are handling the coronavirus. Sylvia Pagioli is in Rome, Anthony Kuhn is in Seoul, and Emily Feng is in Beijing.
Emily, I'm going to start with you because you were covering the crisis in Wuhan from the beginning. Can you just give us a sense now about what was the trajectory of the Chinese response to this?
Well, for the first month after the initial cases of the coronavirus appeared, there wasn't a response. There was this local cover-up and a delay. And during that time, about 5 million people left the virus epicenter and likely spread it to the rest of China. But then the country mobilized, and it did so very quickly. It imposed very stringent self-isolation and quarantine measures. And by self-isolation, I mean people started avoiding densely populated areas. They canceled all public events. They shut down factories and offices. And by quarantine measures, I meant They sealed off cities and villages completely.
Mm-hmm. Anthony, how does what Emily just said compare to what's been happening in South Korea?
Well, South Korea got hit right after China, and because of South Korea's experience with previous epidemics, they decided that rapid mass testing for the virus was going to be the key to their strategy. And so they've been testing around 15,000 people a day, 3,600 people per million of population compared to 5 people per million in the U.S. They've also focused on transparency, putting out daily statistics and press briefings.
Sylvia, in Italy, I mean, now Italy has replaced South Korea as the number 2 in the world after China when it comes to the scope of this pandemic. What has been the Italian response?
Drastic curbs on freedom of movement, and there's been overwhelming compliance. Only food shops, pharmacies, and newsstands are open. People can go out, but if stopped by police, they must show a kind of affidavit that states the purpose, either work, grocery shopping, health, or an emergency. Police are carrying out random checks. They face either 3 months in jail or a fine of $230. The purpose is social distancing, keep people apart. Italy's following China's lead, the Wuhan model.
Mm-hmm. So, Emily, the Wuhan model, has it worked? I mean, transmission has decreased there, has it not?
Yeah, and experts pretty much unanimously agree that's because of social distancing. It will destroy your economy, as it temporarily has in China, but it quickly slows the virus's spread. Another thing China did was it built these makeshift centers where they sent sick people instead of sending them home. And researchers in both the U.S. and China have now said this week that that was critical to slowing down the outbreak. But this could be a measure that Western democracies may be unwilling to take. As for quarantine measures, though, sealing off villages and cities, that's the jury's still out on the efficacy of that, because quarantines made it harder for medical resources to reach the hardest hit areas. And that's probably why fatality rates in the epicenter in China are nearly 4 times higher than the rest of the country.
Hmm. So, Sylvia, how have the measures worked in Italy? What's the situation right now? Is there any slowing?
Well, nationwide, it's too early to say. It hasn't hit the peak yet. The quarantine that was put in place a few weeks ago in the contagion epicenter in Lombardy, 11 towns, 50,000 people, local authorities say it's working. The contagion rate has dropped. And that's why the quarantine was extended to all of Italy, to try to prevent a spread to the south, which has much weaker health systems than those in the north, which are among the best in Europe, but they are severely strained by this crisis now.
Anthony, South Korea chose not to take measures like we've seen in Italy or in China with these dramatic quarantines or lockdowns. And yet it seems like they have still been able to keep the crisis at bay, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, case numbers have been declining for 2 weeks in a row, and fatalities have been at less than 1% compared to about 4% for China and 6% for Italy. And, you know, doing this without having to lock huge regions down is also a kind of effectiveness, a kind of accuracy.
Was there something specifically about South Korea that made it possible for them to avoid large-scale quarantines?
Well, it's, you know, testing capacity is not just about kits. It's about investment in basic healthcare infrastructure, lab technicians, chemicals, machines, logistics. And if any one of those areas has a bottleneck, it's going to mess things up and people are going to lose lives. And it's just, you know, at the end of the day, it's investment in a healthcare system, hospital beds, you know, national health insurance. And this shows up in survivability for all diseases, including COVID-19.
And lastly, Emily and Sylvia, I'd love for you to talk some about how the different political systems in China and Italy have affected the coronavirus response. Emily, you alluded to this earlier, but really, how much of China's success in mitigating the spread has to do with the fact that this is a country, frankly, with a long history of human rights abuses? It is an authoritarian state.
We've seen transparency is critical for a fast response that wasn't present in China. But because China's a very centralized government, one might say authoritarian, it was able to mobilize quarantine measures and social distancing very, very quickly. The problem is quarantines may have cost more lives than we know, but we'll never know the secondary costs of people who were not able to get timely medical care and suffered from it because they were sealed into their villages or cities.
Right. And Sylvia, obviously, Italy is a democracy. What has been just the people's response to these kinds of drastic measures?
The crisis has totally turned the world upside down. Italians, notorious for cutting into line, not very obedient to rules, are become the most compliant brilliant people I've ever seen in my life. And French correspondents based here sent a petition to French President Emmanuel Macron telling him France underestimates the gravity of the epidemic and failed to prepare French public opinion. They say, look at Italy. It's our duty to tell you there's no time to lose.
NPR's Sylvia Pajoli, Anthony Kuhn, and Emily Fang talking with Rachel Martin. Fears about the impact of coronavirus have sparked a financial crisis in the markets. Austin Goolsbee, who chaired President Barack Obama's Council of Economic Advisors, says that as the virus spreads, American markets might be hit even harder than China's. NPR's Ari Shapiro asked him why.
If you look at the economy of the United States or of the rich countries in Europe, they're much more dominated by these face-to-face services that are exactly the things that get pulled down, whether they're leisure and entertainment and sports or going to the gym or all sorts of services. So if everyone stops doing that, that's a bigger hit on the U.S. economy even than it was in China when they shut down.
And you've also said that virus economics are different from regular economics. Explain what you mean by that.
Yeah, by that, I mean the closest thing in our collective memories to this moment was the financial crisis.
Right, in 2008.
But financial crisis economics and business cycle economics is a little different than the virus in that the main thing that is paralyzing the economy is this fear and withdrawal. And so in a way, the best thing you can do for the economy has nothing to do with the economy, with virus economics. And that is things like paid leave for people that are sick is actually not stimulus. It's paying people not to come to work. But anything that slows the rate of spread of the virus is the best kind of stimulus. So if we have to get on top of this as a public health matter, I think, before you can effectively deal with this as an economic matter.
Except if we do slow the rate of the virus and this epidemic continues for weeks or months, is there any way to turn around the financial slide?
Yes and no. No in that, look, there's going to be a substantial slowdown. Our goal is and should be allowing us the opportunity to bounce back as this thing passes over us. And that means you can't let everybody go bankrupt or starve or have these persistent, lasting problems from what we hope to be a temporary shock.
And so do you see the crunch that we're experiencing now as an irrational panic or an appropriate response to the cancellation of big economic engines like pro sports, like Broadway, like school, like the economic activity that goes on in major cities every day?
Yeah, a bit of both. As we, in fear, withdraw and have social distancing to try to slow the virus, there is going to be a substantial slowdown of economic activity.
Right.
But I can never get out of my head from the 2008 crisis, Paul Volcker's words over and over at that time, that during a crisis, the only asset you have is your credibility. And as the U.S. government has not made credible statements, that contributes to fear. That makes it go down, and we've got to do better. We need the president to succeed here.
That was NPR's Ari Shapiro talking with Austin Goolsbee, who chaired President Barack Obama's Council of Economic Advisors. A look now at the impact of coronavirus on our education system. Research shows that closing schools proactively can slow down the spread of the disease. Over 10,000 American schools are now either closed or have announced that they will be closing. But as NPR's Corey Turner reports, making the decision to shutter a school isn't easy.
Nicholas Christakis says his Yale University lab has always been about studying one word.
We study how germs spread. We study how ideas spread. We study how behaviors spread.
Christakis wrote the bestseller Blueprint, The Evolutionary Origins of a Good Society, and his lab is now studying how coronavirus might spread. He says closing schools is one of the most effective things a community can do to slow it down. And it's better, he says, for school leaders not to wait until a student or staff member actually gets sick.
It's sort of closing the barn door after the cow is gone if you wait for the case to occur.
Christakis points to studies of the 1918 Spanish flu. He says cities that were quick to close their schools then saved lives.
Closing the schools before anyone in the schools is sick is a very difficult thing to do, even though it's probably extremely beneficial and much wiser.
School leaders say it's very difficult because so many kids get so much from their schools.
For a large number of our students, the safest place for them to be is actually in school.
Sonia Santelises is the CEO of Baltimore City Public Schools. And she says if she has to cancel school, many parents won't be able to take off work. So children could be heading home to empty households. And that's a worry all over the country.
Yeah, I think that's honestly the hardest contemplation for our districts.
Chris Rakedahl is superintendent of public instruction for Washington State, which has been hit hard by coronavirus.
To send, you know, a million Washington kids home, knowing that for hundreds of thousands of them, they simply will not have any parents at home.
Not only won't there be parents at home, there might not be lunch either.
Food insecurity is a real challenge in our community, even without an emergency.
Alberto Carvalho heads Miami-Dade County Public Schools, and he says roughly three-quarters of his students live at or below the poverty line. These kids not only depend on schools for lunch, they also get free breakfast, free snacks, and many, he says, get free dinner. That's why Carvalho and school leaders all over the country are hustling to build meal plans in case schools have to close. Miami-Dade is adapting its hurricane plan. In Baltimore, Santelises says schools often send kids home on the weekend with a special backpack full of food. And maybe they could do something similar, she says, in the event of a coronavirus closure.
That's only typically gets a family through a weekend. So we have other ideas. We're just trying to see whether they will work in the current context.
There's one more word that has school leaders scrambling right now. Equity. See, if schools have to close for a week or more, school leaders want to be sure that learning doesn't entirely stop. But schools have a legal obligation to make sure that whatever they do works for every child. And that can be expensive. Chris Rakedahl says some schools in Washington State are exploring online learning. And they're asking themselves, does every child have a computer and Wi-Fi and access to staff if they have a disability?
Those are paramount questions for our schools. And if they can't deliver that when they choose to jump to an online model, it's unlikely they're providing a legal basis for an equitable education.
Of all the district leaders I spoke with, only one, Carvalho in Miami-Dade, says he is confident he has the tech resources to keep kids learning, even if school is canceled.
Enabled by a bond referendum that goes back to 2012, we have acquired an excess of 200,000 personal devices.
That's right, 200,000 laptops, tablets, and smartphones that kids can take with them if schools close. But many school leaders told me they may instead have to treat coronavirus like a long, heavy snow, meaning they'll either try to make up the lost days this summer or simply have to write them off. Corey Turner, NPR News.
The United States maintains a huge stockpile of emergency medical supplies. In fact, it's the biggest medical stockpile in the world, and officials have already been dipping into it to help fight coronavirus. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce reports on what the stockpile program can do in this crisis and what it can't.
Before I was allowed to visit one of the strategic national stockpile sites a few years ago, I had to promise never to reveal its location. I walked past armed guards into a huge warehouse that had a giant American flag hanging from the ceiling. The stockpile program's then director, Greg Burrell, gave me a tour.
If you envision, say, a super Walmart and stick two of those side by side and take out all the drop ceiling, that's about the same kind of space that we would occupy in one of these storage locations.
So how many warehouses like this do you all have?
You know, we have an undisclosed number of warehouses.
Almost everything about these places is secret for security reasons. But I once heard an official say in a public meeting that there were six. The warehouses are placed in strategic spots around the country. Each is packed with medical supplies. All in all, about $8 billion worth. Tara O'Toole is executive vice president of InQtel and a former Homeland Security official. She says when the stockpile program got started in 1999, it was much smaller and highly specialized.
And intended to supply drugs we would need if there were a chemical, radiological, biological, or nuclear attack.
so it has material for those threats, like drugs to treat people exposed to radiation, smallpox, and anthrax vaccines. But over the years, the stockpile's mission expanded to include flu pandemics and emergencies like hurricanes or earthquakes. It now holds anti-flu drugs along with basic medical needs like IV fluids and kits, bandages, antibiotics, painkillers.
It's never going to be as big as you want because it's just too expensive to do that.
O'Toole says the stockpile is supposed to fill the gap between when an emergency happens and when manufacturers can ramp up production.
It's a bridge. It's not a replacement for the private sector.
That means there could still be shortages. Take masks, for example. Officials say the stockpile has about 30 million simple surgical masks and 12 million of the more protective N95 masks. That's not going to be enough. Already, Washington State has requested hundreds of thousands of masks from the stockpile and has gotten shipments. More requests are sure to come in. The government says it wants to buy 500 million more masks over the next year and a half.
You know, we wish we had everything that we needed on the shelf all the time, but we have to be respectful of the appropriations Congress provides and live within those.
I caught up with Greg Burrell, who retired from the stockpile program last year. He said in an emergency like this one, another thing from the stockpile that could be useful is its ventilators.
And we can send those out, people can be intubated, and those can help people breathe until they can take back over for themselves.
How many ventilators does the stockpile have? He wouldn't tell me. He just said a lot. Some public sources I've seen suggest that it's at least 4,000. They're all charged up and ready to go, fitted into kits that are easy to move, like a rolling suitcase.
So we tried to think about putting these together in such a way that you can roll it in and use it immediately.
But there might be a problem. If things get bad enough to need all those ventilators, hospitals may be struggling to have enough trained staff to use them. Even though the federal government can provide some supplies from the stockpile, the response to this virus, in the end, comes down to state and local workers. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
This is a special report from NPR News. COVID-19, what you need to know about coronavirus. I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro. Let's take a look at how coronavirus is impacting everyday life and how you can stay healthy. Experts say your first line of defense is good old hand washing. Nothing fancy, just 20 seconds of you, soap, and water. Mary Louise Kelly, host of All Things Considered, met with Maddie Sofia of NPR's Daily Science podcast, Shortwave.
Would you start by just explaining the why? I mean, we all know we're supposed to wash our hands, but is this really keeping us and everybody else from getting sick?
Yeah, so it's actually one of the easiest and most effective ways to prevent getting sick. So a lot of the germs that we worry about get in through our nose and mouth. So if your hands are dirty, that's a problem. And you know, we touch our face a lot. There have been a few studies that show it's more than 15 times per hour.
Oh, my God.
So yeah, it's horrifying. We're gross. And so you definitely want to keep those hands clean.
In preparation for this and boning up, I went online. I watched a video that our editors have sent around.
Uh-oh.
It kind of terrified me because I'm not doing 90% of the things we should be doing. It was super complicated.
Yeah. The instructions from places like the World Health Organization are very intense and will make you feel like you've never washed your hands the right way ever. But the important thing is to do it for long enough, to do the basics, get the soap everywhere. And if you do that, you're probably okay.
Okay, let's do it.
Okay.
Now here we are.
All right, you ready?
NPR sink.
First thing you're going to do, get your little hands wet.
Does it have to be hot?
No, actually it doesn't at all.
Okay, so just lukewarm, room temperature. Yep. All right.
So first you get your hands wet. You can turn that water off. We're not trying to waste water here.
Oh, okay. Yep.
And then get some soap on your hands.
Okay.
And that can be any type of soap. It doesn't need to be antibacterial. It doesn't actually help. It's not better.
Really?
Yeah, seriously.
Just
lather that soap up.
All right.
So you want to get it all over.
This is the extent of my usual hand wash.
Yes.
You're seeing it.
So we're going to go a little more intense today. And so now you want to start kind of scrubbing your hands. And you want to do this for at least 20 seconds. Right. So you can sing happy birthday twice. That's something people do.
Happy birthday to you.
So start with your palms, like you're going to roll up a meatball or some cookie dough.
Got it.
And then you want to turn over one hand and use your other hand to get the backs of your hands and lace your fingers through.
Ooh, I never do that.
Yes, yeah, perfect. And then you want to get around your thumbs.
Okay.
And then the last thing is just you want to get your nails on the palm of your hand and kind of you want to get under your nails because germs love under nails. And this friction actually helps actually remove the germs off of your hands.
Is that about how long we should be doing it for?
Yep, just about 20, 25 seconds. If you're showing off, 30 seconds.
Okay. And competitive hand washing?
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah. We're here to win.
And now
then
we
you
rinse.
Just turn the water on,
same
rinse
thing.
Your hands.
Can
yep.
be hot, can be cold.
Yep. Yeah, you can turn it off with your wrist. You can actually turn it off with your hands. You don't need to use a paper towel. You're totally fine to touch the faucet again, actually.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
Yep, and then this is important. Okay. You want to dry it because your hands are actually better at transmitting germs when they're wet than when they're dry.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Hand sanitizer, is that just as good?
Yeah, it's not quite just as good. Some germs can stick around after hand sanitizer, but it's absolutely better than nothing. You just want to make sure you're using some that has more than 60% alcohol in it. So the alcohol content is pretty important.
Huh.
And in the same case, you want to get a lot of it on, and you want to let it dry. You don't want to wipe it on your pants afterwards.
Yeah, you definitely
you do
you
not.
Do, you
don't
do that for all kinds of reasons.
Yeah.
Maddie Sofia, thank you.
You're welcome.
She is with our daily science podcast, Shortwave.
We all want to stop the spread of coronavirus. The most important thing is to keep health workers safe. That means giving them the protective gear they need, including something called a respirator, which protects someone from breathing in viral particles. NPR science correspondent Joe Palca traveled to the 3M mask manufacturer in Minnesota.
At 3M, they've been thinking about how to respond to the coronavirus outbreak for a while.
In mid-January, we started to notice some strange disease patterns coming out of China.
Nikki McCullough is an occupational safety and health leader at 3M.
We realized that this could be something that we might need to help respond to.
3M makes all kinds of protective equipment, including what are called N95 respirators, the kind of mask healthcare workers are encouraged to wear. 3M already makes millions of these, but more are needed.
We are ramping up production in all of our manufacturing facilities for respirators all over the world.
McCullough and I met at 3M's Global Respiratory Fit Laboratory.
This laboratory is where we take respirators that we've designed and we test them on a variety of people who've got a variety of different faces.
To be protective, a mask has to keep tiny particles floating in the air from entering your nose or mouth. Surgical masks can only block large droplets. N95 respirators, on the other hand, have layers of specialized filter material that will keep out virtually any small particle. But no matter how sophisticated the respirator is, you have to wear it correctly.
And if somebody doesn't put it on properly, or doesn't shave their face before putting it on, they might have some leakage around the edge.
And that could let viral particles seep in. Right now, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says only healthcare workers and people caring for COVID-19 patients need to use N95 respirators, so most people won't need to bother with them. Still, I wanted to know the proper way to wear one, and McCullough was happy to show me.
You want to make sure that it's covering your nose and mouth, and touching your face all the way around.
She places the cup-shaped respirator over her face.
I've now got it over my nose and mouth.
There are two straps attached to the respirator.
So I'm going to use both straps.
She pulls the bottom strap up and over her head, resting it on the back of her head.
And the other strap is going to sit on the crown of my head.
The next thing you do is form the nose clip. This is a metal band at the top of the mask.
And you need to take two fingers and press down on that metal nose clip, starting on your nose all the way across your cheeks.
The last thing is to check for leaks. McCullough holds her hands over the mask and breathes in and out.
If it's got leaks, usually you can feel it up in your eyes, air rushing in your eyes or under your chin.
Now, I've worn these respirators. I was told to wear them when I went to Hong Kong in 2003 to cover the SARS outbreak. I found wearing them distinctly unpleasant. They are hot, and breathing was difficult. I asked McCullough about that.
So, am I just a wuss, or is this a pain in the neck to wear?
Both.
Okay.
McCullough says, yes, they are a bit of a pain to wear.
But people get acclimated to them, just like people get acclimated to wearing a bike helmet when they bike.
And if the alternative is disease, most people actually treating infectious patients have a strong incentive to keep them on. Joe Palca, NPR News.
Trying to keep yourself from contracting coronavirus means engaging in what is being called social distancing. In trying to keep our personal space virus-free, we will have to change virtually every element of how we socialize, including how we greet each other. This means that staple of social norms, the handshake, is under siege. NPR's Yuki Noguchi reports on how the coronavirus is reshaping etiquette.
I contacted Mike Sandifer after seeing his post about alternatives to the handshake. When we meet up, he greets me with an outstretched elbow.
Hi, nice to meet you.
I guess bump.
Plus bump.
Bump, bump. Okay.
After nudging me with his elbow, he scans the lobby.
Where's the restrooms?
Do you see there where the hand sanitizer is?
Hand washing has become a global obsession. It reminds Sandifer of what his mother drilled into him.
Did you wash your hands before dinner? Did you wash your hands after dinner?
Everyone's preaching hand hygiene, and that's made the handshake taboo, as in hashtag no handshake. German Prime Minister Angela Merkel was left hanging after her interior minister denied her outstretched hand. This week, the Dutch Prime Minister announced a no-handshake rule, then promptly turned and shook a health official's hand. He later apologized. Sandifer is a realtor and relates to the deeply ingrained instinct to extend a hand.
You know, people from the South are kind of touchy-feely. We are a handshaking crowd.
But virus and disease also shaped Sandifer's childhood. In the 1960s, his father tended polio patients in iron lungs, and his mother always wore gloves. For fashion, but also for hygiene.
She had beautiful gloves.
The sort of like Downton Abbey type gloves.
Oh, she had gloves of all kinds. They were like knitted.
So what replaces the handshake? That's up for grabs, so to speak. There's the fist bump or a prayer gesture.
The namaste is sort of a nice, I think that that's multicultural and it's around the world.
You know, it's funny because my parents are from Japan. And So in Asian cultures, you don't have a handshake.
No, my grandmother was born in Japan. That's what she taught us, is that when you met people, you bow.
The lack of consensus has made greeting people bewildering and frankly, a bit awkward. Even etiquette experts agree.
So I am Mr. Manners.
Thomas Farley is a New York-based etiquette consultant. His weekend was full of hands-free greetings, including at a birthday party.
The host actually posted a sign which said, this is a hug and kiss-free zone.
That was a coronavirus first for Farley.
And what I liked about it, honestly, was it took some of the awkwardness out of it so that the ground rules were there so that everybody could not feel like the bad person.
At another party, people traded elbow bumps and foot shakes. Except that was weird, Farley says, because this was a house where shoes are left at the door.
That made foot-to-foot contact a little bit more intimate than might be if you were actually wearing shoes.
Farley says he's now rethinking how he teaches business etiquette. One core element had been the perfect handshake. Not flimsy, but not a death grip, and certainly not clammy.
That's the before. Now, of course, we're suddenly thrust into this new era.
But even the new era has its limits for Farley.
To elbow bump or chest bump, it's not professional.
So what's your personal favorite?
I got to tell you, as a Star Trek fan, I love the live long and prosper greeting with the split fingers.
Back with realtor Mike Sandifer. As he gets up to leave, we chat about upcoming plans.
I'm at my birthday's next door.
Oh, happy early birthday.
Thank you.
Don't blow out the candles, I guess. What are you going to do? Like, snuff them out?
I know.
He opens the door, gives me another elbow bump, and we part ways. Yuki Noguchi, NPR News.
See, normally I would have given you a big old hug.
As coronavirus continues to spread, many of us will either have to stay home because we suspect we might be ill or because we actually are. And in preparation for this, federal health officials are now recommending that people stock up on their prescription medications. But boosting your supply of medicine could prove to be tricky. NPR's Patty Naiman reports.
The advice to have an emergency supply of prescription medications is excellent, says Peter Jacobson with the University of Michigan School of Public Health.
People should not be caught short of having enough heart medication, diabetic medication, anything potentially life-saving that they need on a routine, daily or weekly or monthly basis.
But here's the hard part. Most insurance companies have rigid schedules for authorizing refills. Typically, that means if you have, say, a one-month supply, you can't refill it until the 24th day or so. Or if you have a 90-day supply, you can't refill it until the 85th or even 88th day. And Jacobson says working it out with insurance companies can be difficult.
Have you ever tried to deal with your insurer over the phone? First of all, can you even get through? How long do you have to wait online?
How often have you been told to call back or been sent to another department? Here's an alternative. Jacobson says, talk to your pharmacist who can help.
They do it all the time. They're constantly talking to the primary care physician or any specialist on the nature of a prescription, the length of time.
Another option, talk to your primary care physician. Most insurers will relax their refill policies in cases of natural disasters like hurricanes or earthquakes, and that's beginning to happen now with the coronavirus. For example, the health insurance plan provider Anthem is now recommending its members talk with their doctor about whether they need to increase their regular 1 month supply of medication to 3 months. But even with relaxed policies, stockpiling medication could be difficult, especially for low-income people. Frederick Asasi with the consumer advocacy group Families USA.
They're not insured. The cost could be quite prohibitive for them. So it will definitely impact the low-income and working families much more than other folks.
And even if they are insured, Asasi says copays could end up being just too much, especially for expensive drugs like insulin.
Folks are routinely getting hit with very expensive copayments for insulin. In those instances, even insured families who are low income will really have a hard time being able to afford to pay for that stockpile of insulin.
It's not clear how much extra medication people should have on hand. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention calls for an emergency supply. The Department of Homeland Security says a continuous supply, but neither specifies whether that means 1 month or 3 months. Patty Naiman, NPR News.
So let's say you woke up this morning feeling not so great. Maybe you have a cough, maybe a fever, could be a cold, could be an allergy. It's hard, though, not to think about the coronavirus, right? But until testing becomes more widely available, you might not be able to find out. Public health officials say anyone with symptoms akin to the coronavirus should call their doctor, but they might be told to just stay at home and write it out. Here's NPR's Maria Godoy.
Last Wednesday, Washington, D.C. resident Shapri Lamaglio returned from a nearly month-long trip across Italy, a country experiencing an explosive outbreak of coronavirus cases. Back in the U.S., airport signs from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention asked travelers to call their doctor if they started feeling cold or flu symptoms. Then Sunday morning,
I woke up feeling congested and with a small cough.
Her temperature was also slightly elevated.
I wanted to do the responsible thing and call my healthcare provider and tell them where I had traveled to.
But when she asked her doctor about getting tested for COVID-19, the disease caused by the coronavirus, Lamaglia was told to call the CDC. After a 4.5-hour wait to speak with someone from the CDC hotline, the advice Lamaglia got was, call your doctor.
And I told her, I said, I feel like I'm in Groundhog Day.
Lamaglio is now waiting to hear back from the D.C. Department of Health about whether she qualifies for a test. But she says her symptoms have now abated, and she thinks they were more likely due to seasonal allergies than the coronavirus. But she's decided to isolate herself from others as best she can, just to be safe.
Your entire population has to understand exactly what the disease is, what the enemy is.
Dr. Bruce Aylward of the World Health Organization says it's important that everyone learn to recognize the symptoms of COVID-19.
It's a high fever, 90% of cases, a dry cough in 70% of them. You also have to know what it is not. It's not the sniffles. It's not a runny nose. That can be a symptom, but that's rare.
In an ideal world, people who have both these key symptoms would get tested right away. But even though testing capacity is increasing in the U.S., the demand for tests still outstrips the supply. Kritika Kapali is an infectious disease doctor and a fellow at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. She says, for now, people considered to be in more vulnerable groups are likely to get prioritized for testing.
If I have a symptomatic individual that's 65 and has a chronic medical condition compared to a 20-year-old who has mild symptoms, I would probably be more inclined to test the older person.
She says people who are immunocompromised and healthcare workers are also likely to get prioritized. The important thing for people who don't fall into these categories but do have symptoms is to take precautions not to spread whatever is making them sick.
So the one thing I keep telling people, you think you're sick enough to be tested for it, and you should not be going out in public.
Kupali notes that 80% of coronavirus cases are considered mild, which means you should be prepared to ride it out at home like you would with other respiratory illnesses, with fever reducer, rest, and plenty of fluids. Just keep your doctor informed of your symptoms to make sure you're not getting worse. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
While we've given you a lot of information this hour, we should note that there's still much more that we don't know about this virus. For example, is it seasonal? How much protection will an eventual vaccine give? Why doesn't it affect children in the same way as adults? We're constantly getting new information from experts, and we'll keep sharing that information with you on air and at npr.org. Also check the federal government's coronavirus website. That's at cdc.gov. And please keep abreast of announcements from your city and state governments. And while this is a hard time for everyone, if you are struggling with your mental health, make sure you check in with a mental health provider who can help. You've been listening to a special report from NPR News, COVID-19, What You Need to Know About Coronavirus. I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro. And one last reminder, please keep washing those hands.